dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go,
you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, or WXXC Truxton. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Tonight's program will deal entirely with the so-called National Missile Defense Program, also known as Star Wars. I strongly encourage you to tape the show tonight. It is, in my opinion, some of the most urgent and critical information that we have presented here during what has now been 1 year on the air. I urge you to call your friends and relatives and tell them to tune in. Star Wars is not about defense against an evil empire. It is a plan to extend the power of an evil empire to every nook and cranny of this world and beyond. It is about world domination and the use of space-based weapons to enforce corporate rule. If this sounds like the Third Reich rising again, that's no coincidence, as you will hear. Our speakers tonight are SUNY Journalism Professor Carl Grossman, David Parnas, a former Defense Department scientist, and a soldier-turned-peace activist, Bruce Gagnon. The evidence they present comes from government documents, conferences, and defense contractor trade publications. It's chilling stuff, because it makes quite clear that the purpose of this U.S. military program is not to defend democracy, but to eradicate it. There is an evil empire. We must become the Rebel Alliance.
By stealing and lying and gambling, and I take it my way, my shiny black vest. I treat horses good.
Last year, Science for Peace held a forum on national missile defense in Toronto. Now, we bring you two presentations from that event.
We're very pleased to have as our keynote speaker Carl Grossman. Carl is a professor of journalism at the State University of New York College at Old Westbury, and he has specialized in investigative reporting for more than 30 years. He chairs the SUNY Old Westbury's Media and Communications Program. He's authored a number of books, of which the one most relevant for us today is The Wrong Stuff, The Space Program's Nuclear Threat to Our Planet. He is the writer and narrator of the award-winning video documentary Nukes in Space, The Nuclearization and Weaponization of the Heavens. And his journalism on the use of nuclear power and plans for weapons in space has been repeatedly cited in the annual judging of the Project Censored Awards as being underreported and censored by the U.S. media. The first citation Grossman received from Project Censored was in 1987 for his revelation in 1986 in The Nation, the magazine The Nation, at the next scheduled mission of the ill-fated shuttle Challenger involved a plutonium-fueled space probe. This last April, he again received a Project Censored Award for his investigative reporting on the use of nuclear power and U.S. plans for weapons in space. He has spoken on these issues around the world, so we're delighted that he's here with us today in Canada, in Toronto. He's addressed members of the British Parliament twice. He's given presentations at the United Nations in Geneva and New York and at the Hague Appeal for Peace Conference, which a number of people in this room, including myself, were at. Last year, he's spoken at the United Nations in Geneva and New York, and so on. His articles on space issues have appeared in the Canadian newspapers The Globe and Mail and the Montreal Mirror, and he's been interviewed on CBC television, received many citations for his journalism. So, Carl Grossman.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure being in Toronto, I can tell you. The last time I think I was in Toronto, I was covering a U.S. political convention, and I was, after 4 days of it, it was Niagara Falls. It was so sickening and so outrageous. I jumped in a car and I just drove to Toronto and saw some sanity, enjoyed a, in my judgment, a more civilized society's company. Missile defense is the claim. It's not just missile defense. Missile defense is one layer of an overall program that the United States is embarking on for space warfare. You know, this sounds outrageous. To control space, from space to dominate the planet below. It sounds extreme. I mean, really? The United States? And I'm not naive about U.S. history. I did a book in the 80s on U.S. intervention in Central America. It was called Nicaragua, America's New Vietnam. So I know the history, but we're talking here something way beyond the Monroe Doctrine. Indeed, when I did a presentation last year at the House of Commons in London, looking at some of these official U.S. military documents, one member of Parliament, Alan Simpson, like he grabbed at this one, you'll see it in a second in a slide, Vision for 2020. That's the year 2020. And this is from the U.S. Space Command. Shows a laser in space zapping a target below. Opens up with the declaration, U.S. Space Command dominating the space dimension of military operations to protect U.S. interests and investment. Goes on about how during the rise of sea commerce, nations built navies to protect and enhance their commercial interests. The great empires of Europe, the Spanish, the French, the Dutch, rule the waves and thus were able to rule the earth. And the United States of America sees that as a model. We would control space, rule space, and from space rule the earth below. And then it goes on here. Some of you might be quite involved in the issue of the World Trade Organization, the whole issue of the global economy. And here from, again, this is from the Pentagon. The globalization of the world economy will continue with a widening between haves and have-nots. Of course, the U.S. is the locomotive of the global economy, and the U.S. military apparently feels its new mission is to keep those have-nots in line. From, again, this sounds fantastic. And Simpson, Alan Simpson, he's an MP from Nottingham. He grabbed at this brochure, and he stood up and he said, Professor Grossman, we understand. We know what it is to be an empire. We know what it is to be drunk with power. And that, I'm sad to say, is what my country is involved in. Being an empire, being drunk with power. We'll have a further discussion of national missile defense, but as I stress, national missile defense from the outset, from the time in 1983, when Reagan first unveiled the program for Star Wars, was one layer in a multi-layered program of missile defense, theater defense, space-based weapons. They stressed back in the 80s space-based weapons. There was Edward Teller's notion of the Excalibur hydrogen bomb-energized weapon system in space, and I mean, even the U.S. public didn't cotton to that. So now in coming back with Star Wars. And in fact, Star Wars never died. It developed a momentum of its own. In terms of pure budget, it's continued to have a budget of, well, at this point, it's over $6 billion a year. And that's not the money that's in the black, that's secret. This time around, the stress is defense, missile defense. We'll start at that layer instead of the space-based layer, the space-based weapons layer, because, I mean, that's the most palatable defense. I mean, you could hear the strains of Remember Pearl Harbor in the background. But again, this is not missile defense. It's quite an offensive program. Let me run you through a series of slides here. I mean, unless you see the documents, it's really hard to believe what the United States is up to. I teach a course in investigative reporting. Actually, it's supposed to be the oldest such course in the United States. And what I tell my students is no matter what, any source, any would-be deep throat tells you, go to the documents. Go to the unvarnished documents, and there you can see the reality of the situation. And it's a little light in the room, which is kind of a nice thing in one way. But there's the cover of Vision for 2020. And we're talking about the year 2020. 20 years, two decades from now. And as a lot of us know, a decade goes in a day, it seems. This is the vision the United States has for just a few years from now of weapons in space. You can't see it too well, but up in the right-hand corner is a laser zapping a target below. And here, sort of, this is life of sorts, imitating art, like the Star Wars movies begin, you know, with that crawl and the words get narrower and narrower on the screen. U.S. Space Command dominating the space dimension of military operations to protect U.S. interests and investment. Then it goes on, as I was mentioning before, during the rise of sea commerce, nations built navies to protect and enhance their commercial interests. And here, the globalization of the world economy will continue with a widening between haves and have-nots. Over and over again, U.S. space dimension dominating the space dimension, dominate. The words domination, control, master, over and over again, these are used, and it's no accident. That's the intent of this whole scheme, dominating the space dimension of military operations to protect U.S. national interests and investment. This is the back cover of Vision for 2020. Space, the warfighter's view. It's kind of a nightmarish Earth Day poster. The long-range plan. This is the Fuller document. The long-range plan. Here it is. 113 pages of the plan. And they begin, this is the second page of the long-range plan. This is kind of interesting. The long-range plan, U.S. Space Command's number one priority for the past 11 months, investing nearly 20 man-years to make it reality. The development and production process by design involved hundreds of people, including about 75 corporations. Our President Dwight Eisenhower warned the United States in 1959 of a military-industrial complex being involved in setting U.S. policy. I mean, here's the military-industrial complex in spades, and the military is extremely proud of it. Indeed, you don't need to be much of an investigative reporter when you see how 75 corporations admittedly were involved in really determining U.S. military doctrine. They call these kinds of things. This is military doctrine. They list the 75 corporations. They're so bullish. And incidentally, these reports are available on the Internet. The website is www.spacecom.af.mil/US-space, or go, this is an easier website, www.space4peace.org, www.space4peace.org. That's the website of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space, and on that website you'll have a link to the U.S. Space Command website, and you can get all this stuff. There's the 75 corporations listed. From Boeing to Lockheed Martin, the world's biggest weapons manufacturer, to Sparta Corporation, aptly named, to TRW, and so forth and so on. Control of space. I mean, this is what the United States is up to. Control of one nation, as was mentioned. One nation wants to take over the commons of space. Totally in violation of the Outer Space Treaty of 1967, which the United States, not too incidentally, was central in developing. I mean, that's the basic international law on space, that space should be used for peaceful purposes. 91 nations have signed the Outer Space Treaty, of course, including the United States. Global engagement. Now, this is important. This is towards the ends of the long-range plan. It's very critical, as far as the United States is concerned, to have partners in this effort, particularly for command and control. We need you guys in Canada. We need Greenland. We need Menwith Hill and the United Kingdom and so forth. We need facilities all around the world as partners in this scheme for the United States to control the planet from space. And here is a page, potential initiatives to enable control of space, global engagement, and so forth. And there are the flags. There are the flags of our would-be partners. And I see the maple leaf. And there's the flag of France, the flag of Germany. You're to the right of Germany. Sorry to break the news. Indeed, that was the principal reason why Clinton punted on national missile defense 6 weeks ago. I mean, partly was because the thing doesn't seem to work. You can't hit a bullet with another bullet. But beyond the two failures out of three tests, there was great objection from the world. The world is quite aware of what the United States is up to, even though, frankly, the U.S. citizenry is not. That has to do with a failure of I'm quite ashamed to say I've been a reporter all my life, journalist all my life, of the American media to report on this issue properly. Guardians of the High Frontier. This is an Air Force Space Command a report. U.S. Space Command is an amalgamation of the Air Force, the Navy, the Army Space Command. It's based in Colorado Springs, Colorado. Space is the ultimate high ground. This is how they think of space. The ultimate high ground. The heavens, the ultimate high ground. It's just not words. Here's the Air Force Space Command headquarters. I mean, the facilities around Colorado Springs now are... Dr. Strangelove has returned to Colorado Springs and Cheyenne Mountain we're talking about space war. The Space Warfare Center at the Falcon Air Force Base in Colorado Springs. This is a great motto of the Air Force Space Command. Master of Space. Master. I did this presentation in Germany last year. A fellow raised his hand from the audience and he said, I don't do a German accent. Well, Professor Grossman, that's very, very close to master race, is it not? And I said, the thinking has to be, very close, sir. I'm ashamed to say. The entrance to the 50th Space Wing, Master of Space. And I downloaded that, incidentally, from the internet. I mean, they're proud of it. No shame. Phillips Laboratory, that's the Air Force Research and Development Facility. Phillips Laboratory supports the warfighter. It's in Albuquerque. Phillips Laboratory is helping in boldface. They actually put it in boldface. Control space for the United States. I mean, what gives one nation the right to think it can control space? I mean, come on. U.S. Space Command prepares for future combat missions in space. This is from a trade journal, Aviation Week in Space Technology, an interview with General Joseph Ashy, at that time Commander-in-Chief of the U.S. Space Command. We'll expand into these two missions, he says, space control and space force application. Space control is controlling space. Space force application is our military's term for controlling the Earth from space. Because they will become increasingly important, the general predicted. We will engage terrestrial targets someday, ships, airplanes, land targets from space. We will engage targets in space, from space. It's politically sensitive, says General Ashy, but it's going to happen. Some people don't want to hear this, and it sure isn't in vogue, but absolutely. We're going to fight in space. We're going to fight from space. We're going to fight into space. Missile defense? Keith Hall, he is the Assistant Secretary of the Air Force for Space. He's also the head of the National Reconnaissance Office, which has a multi-billion dollar budget. There's a speech to the National Space Society in the U.S. with regard to space dominance. Can catch the words, dominance, control. We have it, we like it, and we're going to keep it. This is the attitude. Seeking American space dominance in space news. Again, over and over again, control. Here's frankly the Mein Kampf, the whole plan. Big book, The Future of War, by two think tank types, the Friedmans, George and Meredith Friedman. Power, technology, the future of war, power, technology, and American world dominance. Dominance in the 21st century. And if you want to save yourself $35 American, this is the conclusion of the book. By the year 1500, it was apparent that the European experience of power would be its domination of the global seas. It does not take much to see that the American experience of power will rest on the domination of space. Just as Europe expanded war and its power to the global oceans, the United States is expanding war and its power into space. Just as Europe shaped the world for half a millennium, so too the United States will shape the world for at least that length of time. For better or worse, America has seized hold of the future of war and with it, for a time, the future of humanity. God bless America. This is a little interview with Parade magazine. The big fallacy, there is a logic here. We do have the technology to move into space with weapons. And we can do it pretty quickly, and we're planning to do it pretty quickly. But as soon as we do it, the Chinese are going to do it, and the Russians are going to do it, and the Indians. What are we going to gain? There'll be an arms race in space. There'll be war in space. We'll have turned the heavens into a war zone. Who is going to gain? That's TRW, Lockheed Martin, Boeing, of course. But, who is to... And here's an interview with Friedman. He said, the age of the gun is over. He who controls space controls the battlefield. And this is interesting. This is the myopia of the U.S. strategy. Russia, Japan, now China, passing blips since they lack the money and or technology to compete with us in the development of space-age weapons. Again, the enormous flaw in the logic here. This is Monday was the final deadline for comments on the space-based laser readiness demonstrator. This is one of the programs now under development. An environmental assessment has come out. Big, thick one. Talk about a $30 billion program in coming years. It's interesting. Here's the laser shooting its ray, and I don't know if you can see it in the light, but somehow they were able to get the Old Glory to wave above the laser in space. I don't know how many billions that took, but ingenious, those Americans. This is the another laser, the high-energy laser, which was just tested a few months ago. Megawatt laser test brings space-based lasers one step closer, and the caption, turning swords into lasers. And now we're a little bit out of focus, but again, the world is familiar with what the United States is up to. The U.S. citizenry is not, but the world is. And in November 1st, at the United Nations General Assembly, there was a vote on reaffirming the Outer Space Treaty, and specifically its provision that space shall be used for peaceful purposes, carried out in the benefit and in the interest of all humanity. The vote, 138 nations in favor, including Canada. And let me note, at the United Nations, Canada has been a leader in challenging this U.S. program. A leader. 138 nations in support, 2 abstentions. The United States, and I'm ashamed for a number of reasons to say Israel, went along with the United States in that vote. Here is the U.S. essentially becoming a rogue state in the United Nations as far as space is concerned. Now, I got into this issue, mentioned before that I broke the story about how the Challenger's next mission in May of 1986 was to loft a plutonium-fueled space probe. And, I found that out in a little government document in 1985, that 2 shuttles were to be launched in 86 with plutonium-fueled space probes. One of my main interests has been nuclear power, the dangers of nuclear power. First book, Cover Up, What You're Not Supposed to Know About Nuclear Power, 1980, after the 3 Mile Island accident, told me that, hey, man, this is a dangerous technology. I remember driving to work to teach my investigative reporting class after NASA, when I finally got the documents from NASA, said, oh, yeah, we could have a disaster if one of these plutonium-fueled space probes on the shuttle ended up in some tragedy, some sort of launch accident or a fallback from orbit and so forth. But the likelihood of a catastrophic shuttle accident, 1 in 100, NASA insisted in 1985. The Challenger accident occurred. They changed the odds right away of a catastrophic shuttle accident to 1 in 76. In science, and there's a lot of scientists in the audience, you only know true probability likelihood through empirical evidence. But I kept wondering as the years went by and I kept investigating nukes in space. Why? In fact, NASA was planning to send up on the Challenger in May of 86 the Ulysses space probe to orbit the sun. You couldn't use solar photovoltaic power on a trip around the sun? Why nukes in space? And some of it, if you want to look at what the United States ever does, you can, kind of insult your intelligence and look at the ideology or the philosophy of better you look at who's making money. That's what Deep Throat, the informant in the Watergate case, told Bob Woodward. Follow the money. And in this situation, who's making a buck off nukes in space? Well, it turns out General Electric, which in fact does quite the opposite than bringing good things to light. Lockheed Martin, in fact, bought that GE Aerospace division, which, with the National Laboratory System in the U.S., first developed plutonium fuel space probe systems. Actually, initially, they were for satellites as well. This is not the sky is falling, this discussion of nukes in space. There's been three major accidents involving U.S. nuclear-powered space systems, including the SNAP-9A, which came down in 1964. It was a satellite with a plutonium system aboard, which caused NASA to develop photovoltaic for satellites, and satellites now are done with photovoltaic. The national laboratories obviously wanted to see nukes in space in the United States to keep, particularly in the post-Cold War era, to keep busy doing things nuclear. We don't need any more nuclear weapons. We had 30,000. We're down to 7,000 with an agreement with the former Soviet Union. I mean, what else can they do with nuclear to keep Los Alamos and Oak Ridge and Argonne going? And then I got to the third, and it turns out to be a central element. A lot of these plans for weapons in space rest on nuclear technology, nuclear power. As this report, New World Vistas, Air and Space Power for the 21st Century, an Air Force Board report states, in the next two decades, new technologies will allow the fielding of space-based weapons of devastating effectiveness, lasers able to affect very many kills. Aren't we happy about that? And then it goes on. The problem here, power limitations restrict space-based weapons. A natural technology to enable high power in space is nuclear power. And then it goes on, setting the emotional arguments about nuclear power inside, nuclear, and so forth and so on. I'll just go quick. I think I'm coming out of time. But in terms of nukes in space, this is a report, Emergency Preparedness for Nuclear-Powered Satellites, which Canada, in fact, was involved in preparing in 1989. Here they talk about that SNAP-9A accident. It carried 2.1 pounds of plutonium. A worldwide soil sampling program carried out in 1970 showed SNAP-9A debris to be present at all continents and all latitudes. That accident caused, according to John Gottman, University of California at Berkeley, an increased level of lung cancer on Earth. And you guys, I mean, you were hit with the worst. This was there's a big book on it. I have it right over there. This is the Cosmos that came down in 1978, the Cosmos satellite, the Northwest Territories. During the first few weeks of search, it became apparent the sizable amounts of radioactive debris survived reentry, spread out a 600-kilometer path from Great Slave Lake to Baker Lake. Talked about fragments. A huge mess in the Northwest Territories. Operation Morning Light is a book I would recommend on the issue, published in London. I think I'm going to go very quick here. This was the Cassini space probe, which was launched in 1997. This had more plutonium than any space device, 72.3 pounds. In 1999, they had it do a flyby, a whip around the Earth, to give it enough velocity to be able to reach its destination of Saturn. Final environmental impact statement for the Cassini. This is in August of 1999. If it didn't come in at 42,000 miles an hour, a few hundred miles high, and stay a few hundred miles high, but impact of the Earth's atmosphere, 75-mile-high atmosphere, you'd have, and this is NASA's official environmental impact statement, an inadvertent reentry. And approximately 5 billion of the Earth's population would receive 99% or more of the radiation exposure. NASA then goes on to say 2,000 people would die. Dr. Ernest Sternglass, University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine, using the NASA data that I provided him, calculated, 20 to 40 million people would die. This is the NASA plan. If the Cassini came down in, an urban area like we're in here, Toronto, they talk about demolish some or all structures, relocate affected population permanently. I mean, what nerve to subject the planet to this? In fact, Cassini got off okay and it whipped by the Earth okay, but 5 weeks later, the Mars Climate Observer doing a pass over Mars, 5 weeks later, September 1999, there was a screw-up, a foul-up. They calculated the altitude wrong for it to fly by Mars, a little too low, and it disintegrated, broke up in the Martian atmosphere and came down. The reason? A little article about the reason. One NASA group was calculating altitude in feet, the other one in meters. In fact, NASA doesn't factor into its likelihood or probability estimates human failure. I mean, how can you calculate stupidity? There's eight more of these space probe, these plutonium space probe shots planned. The next one is in 2003. It's to Europa, the moon of Jupiter. The same year, 2003, the European Space Agency will be launching its Rosetta space probe beyond the orbit of Jupiter to rendezvous with some comet I never heard of called Wirtanen with solar instead of plutonium aboard. This is a press release from the European Space Agency, slightly out of focus, which talks about how new solar cells are able to provide power even for space probes, not just satellites anymore. And in fact, they talk about Rosetta getting power 675 million kilometers from the sun, where sunlight is 20 times weaker than on the Earth through solar power. Most recent accident was in 1996. This is a Russian Mars space probe with plutonium on it coming down over the Atacama Desert region in Chile and Bolivia. I mean, accidents happen, in fact, in both the U.S. and Soviet slash now Russian space program. There's been a 15% accident history. Let me just go quick to, this is the Outer Space Treaty, which says exploration of space, the benefit and interest of all countries, province of all mankind. It also says that states shall be liable for accidents in space. Well, cute. The United States in 1991 entered into a space nuclear power agreement, which provides that in the event of an accident with one of our space nuclear power systems, it would be covered by our Price-Anderson Act. That's our Price-Anderson Act, which limits liability in the event of a catastrophic nuclear accident to, I mean, here it is, $100 million for all people affected outside the U.S., $8.9 billion for U.S. damage. So if our next plutonium fuel space probe shot comes down on Canada, or on Europe, or on Africa, or in Asia, the people who will suffer will end up getting just pennies on the dollar. And just some quick slides. This is not just a matter of information. I mean, I've tried to share the information with you today, and I hope you can carry on and share it with others. I have packets of all these documents for you to refocus. Sometimes you got to see them in color to see the, as Simpson said at the House of Commons, he says, you got to see these in color to see the brazenness. And he ran around Westminster looking for a color Xerox, which he finally found and photocopied them in color. This issue requires more than just, and this has been my life, spreading information. It requires organization, it requires mobilization, and it requires resistance. Grandmothers for Peace, and a particularly subversive organization, leading a march against Cassini at Cape Canaveral. This is what they came into. This is the NASA SWAT team, the face of U.S. democracy. The people going over the fence and getting arrested, civil disobedience. Other energy sources are available. I mean, the risk is not necessary, and certainly the weapons in space are not necessary. Cancel Cassini, that's a protest at the White House. European Space Agency says solar works. It's the radioactivity stupid. That's Bill Salzman, incidentally, a former Roman Catholic priest. He's the director of Citizens for Peace in Space. This is another protest at the White House, Keep Space for Peace. This is a conference held by the major international organization challenging U.S. plans to turn the heavens into a war zone, the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space. That's actually me speaking last week this time as part of this series of international demonstrations, which this afternoon's event is part of, down in Wall Street last week. And then finally, there's some U.S. officials, I might say, who are right there on this issue. That's Congressman Dennis Kucinich, who was the keynote speaker at the Global Networks Conference in April at American University, international conference on this. Again, Keep Space for Peace. And he had made a speech at the House of Representatives earlier in that week saying, we must have peace on Earth, not war in space, not war in space. Now, let me just conclude with two things. One, it's the wonderful position of Canada. This is the position in the United Nations of the Canadian delegation. Mark Vidrecaire, counselor on the UN delegation. I had the honor to be on a panel with him at the UN last year. For some time now, the conference in disarmament has before it the idea of negotiating the ban of weaponization of outer space. In January 1997, Canada first formally proposed the negotiation of a legally binding instrument for that purpose. And it goes on how they repeated that in 1999. And the Outer Space Treaty, the original intent was no weapons in space, but it ended up in the process of getting ratified saying no weapons of mass destruction or nuclear weapons in space. What Canada and China and most of the world is saying, let's go back to the original intent, no weapons in space. And here, this is important. This, the counselor says, we have heard often before that there is no arms race in space. We would like to keep it that way for the sake of our own Canadian national security and for international peace and security as a whole. There is no question that the technology can be developed to place weapons in outer space. There is no question that no state can expect to maintain a monopoly on such knowledge of such capabilities for all time. If one state actively pursues the weaponization of space, we can be sure others will follow. That's the Canadian position. And interestingly, in Geneva at the United Nations last year when I gave a presentation on this to a room like this of delegates looking at these documents. I mean, these are folks who negotiate with the United States on arms control issues. Their jaws were dropping. What is the United States up to? And in fact, the next day at the conference for disarmament, there was an effort to have the Outer Space Treaty strengthened, no weapons in space. And I'm ambling along to go to the meeting to see what's happening in the other direction. Let me put it this way, a high U.S. official, a member of the U.S. delegation, who was in the room the day before, and was he looking at me with daggers in his eyes, comes over to me, and we'd have a kind of a man-to-man talk. And this kind of like filled in some of the dots. He says, look, Hall, in the wake of the Vietnam War, we can't field large numbers of ground troops anymore. We did it for Desert Storm, but took 9 months of a drum roll. But we can project power from space, and nobody else can, and that's why the military is moving in that direction. Look, my reply was, you know, I mean, there's issues of morality, and I mean, I told him I'm not naive. I told him what I mentioned to you before. I did this book on Nicaragua, but I mean, this is way beyond the Monroe Doctrine, friend. You know, I mean, the U.S. is going to control. I mean, this would be like literally USA uber alles. I mean, my uncles did not come to this continent 55 years ago to fight for this kind of United States. But I mean, beyond that, once we do it, you have to expect that China will be up there and Russia will be, the military has done an analysis and the conclusion, China 30 years behind us in space military technology. Russians don't have the money. So, look, I've been to China. It's an industrial dynamo. I mean, they're so good at space shots. I mean, at this point, a lot of our U.S. corporations are using the Chinese for launches. Indeed, there's talk now of them launching an astronaut within the next year. Not 30 years, my friend. 3 years they'd be up there. And as to the Russians, I had just been in Moscow. I've been to the Space Museum. I mean, this is a country highly, highly proficient in space activity. It may not have the rubles today, but it's a country rich in natural resources. I traveled to Russia. Been there 3 times, like the last 2 years. I mean, once the U.S. moves to deploy weapons in space, you have to expect we will be followed. And as I mentioned before, no one will gain. We all must come together and say, as the Outer Space Treaty said, space shall be used for peaceful purposes. It's kind of like chemical warfare after World War I. We got to draw the line. We have to draw the line. And frankly, I think the line should be drawn way, way in terms of human conflict. But space should not be and cannot be made an arena of war. And again, it's a pleasure being here. And in my judgment, maybe it's rosy-eyed, this highly sane and civilized nation of Canada. And I just plead with you today to guide your neighbor to the south and, moreover, to pressure your neighbor to the south, this peaceful, great nation of Canada. Lead the United States, please, in doing the right thing. Thank you.
That was Carl Grossman, professor of journalism at SUNY Old Westbury. He is the author of The Wrong Stuff, The Space Program's Threat to Our Planet.
Next is David Parnas. David directs the software engineering program at McMaster University. That is to say, he is a real scientist. As a longtime consultant to the U.S. Department of Defense and its contractors, he was invited to consult for President Reagan's Strategic Defense Initiative, or Star Wars, program in 1985, and he resigned from the SDI Blue Ribbon Panel when it became apparent that the program's publicly stated goals were not taken seriously by the scientists and engineers involved, who were making false statements to advance their own interests. And I think that's He's going to continue this story. I think he's going to speak to us today under the title, From the Liars Who Brought You Star Wars. And, of course, I've left at the end Dr. Parnas's most important qualification. He's a former member of, former president of Science for Peace. Thank you.
Before I go into my prepared talk, I have one thought that is stimulated by the last three. We're entering a new century. When we entered the previous century, the United States did not think of itself as a world power. Thought of itself as a very minor player, had very isolationist tendencies. And today, we see other countries who say they're not world powers, but I don't know what it'll be like when we're well into the next century. None of us do. Could I have the first slide, please? Now, I want to begin this talk by saying that I really have nothing new to say. And I think I'm giving this talk because I had a little chance to think about this. I've actually been turning down opportunities to talk about MMD because I thought I had nothing new to say. But when Mel called me, I happened to be abroad and had a little time to think before I talked to him. And I realized that there's something new in saying that I have nothing new to say. And I'll try to show you what I want with me. For those of you who don't know me, and I'm really glad to look around and see so many young faces. I was afraid I'd see all the people I knew only older, but I see a lot of new people here, and that's encouraging. I'm somebody who's had a change of life. I'm also, by the way, part of the brain game. I was born in the evil empire, unlike Sergei. And I came here about 82. But I continued as a consultant for the Defense Department. I never had much second thought about it at that time. And one of the things this has done for me, by the way, is to let me read some of the real documents, not the ones that come out in color, but the real documents that are usually black and white and are classified. And I can tell you they're much more frightening than the ones that Professor Grossman has talked to us about. I can't tell you much more than that, and I haven't read any lately. But the precision and of the planning and the way of thinking is much more frightening than the science fiction that you sometimes read in those colored brochures. Now, I got into this because I was asked, as somebody who had done a lot of consulting on military projects, in fact, somebody who initiated a military project that's still running today, might be the longest scientific project in the U.S. Navy, longest lived one, and to serve on a panel that was supposed to advise the SDIO office on what they should do with their research money. Sounded to me like it would be really challenging. I couldn't really imagine how to tackle a problem like that, and I thought I'd learn. And I sat for 2 days, and then I did a lot of reading and thinking, and I began to hear some of the biggest BS I'd ever heard in my life. And I'll tell you a little more about it. But they asked us at the end of all these presentations of what they were going to do in the discussions that we had, they asked us to write little position papers about what they should fund. And we were told, by the way, that we shouldn't be humble. If we thought they should fund our research, they'd be glad to. That's part of the way this mechanism works that I want to talk about. Well, what happened was I had a little bit of honesty left in me, I guess. And when I tried to write down how to solve this problem, it became very clear to me that one couldn't. And I resigned, but I didn't want to lose my consulting on other weapon systems. At that time, I didn't feel that there was anything wrong there. And so I tried to carefully explain. That means papers no longer than 2 pages each, so military officers could read them. And I wrote 8 little papers to try to explain to them the issues that I saw. These papers have become, and in some ways I regret this, probably my most widely published and translated papers, because I didn't want to be known for what I didn't do, but more for what I did. Anyway, I had this big sense of deja vu when this thing came up again. So let me tell you a little bit about what happened back then. Could I have the next slide, please? When I wrote those papers, and they very rapidly began to circulate in sort of an underground way, I directed them with my resignation letter to the people that had hired me. I did not broadcast them. But I think they were pretty good papers, and they began to be circulated and eventually landed in the New York Times, and that changed a lot of things. But when I was circulating them and when they were circulating among the defense industry, I began to get some amazing responses. For example, even in those two-day meetings, I pointed out, because of my experience with weapon systems, a major flaw in the simulation they were doing. And the answer I got blew my mind. The guy smiled. He said, yeah, that's the nice thing about this project. There's always more work to do. And then as these papers went around, they began to say things, of course you're right, Dave, but it doesn't matter. They began to try to remind me of something that I already knew, that it was a good way to get money for computer science. And then people would come up with things like, well, we must be able to do something about this problem. Maybe not what they say, but something. And we'll do something useful with the money. One of the companies, which I noticed is still up on that chart that Professor Grossman showed, they told me that in our corporation, we don't tell our customers that what they're doing is silly. We just take their contracts. And my letters even got as far, in fact, I sent them there, to the president's science advisor, who I thought would think. And his response was, my job is to advise the president on how to do what he wants, not to tell him that it can't be done. Now, in all of this, what really amazed me is that in these private conversations, nobody denied the truth of what I said. In fact, they thought it was kind of obvious and even called me sophomoric for saying it. What did my colleagues do? If we can have the next slide. Well, basically, they kept taking the contracts. And they made statements to the public over and over again in every forum you could find that there was no problem, that there were no limits to what you could do with software, that they would be able to deploy something useful in within 2 or 3 years to start deployment. They accused me at one point of being somebody who would never work on any weapon system, even though I had been working 15 years on weapon systems. They accused me of being unprofessional at the same time that I won professional responsibility awards. They accused me of being angry because they didn't pick my projects. I hadn't proposed any. They accused me of being out for publicity. Or maybe I like it, I don't know. But they kept saying they could do it. And all this time, they knew as well as I did that it could never be done. The security being offered by Reagan could never be done. And they knew they were lying to the public. So what happened then? What happened then is that the SDI project went on, but they never got close to doing what they said they could do. And then Clinton came in, and it was publicly announced that he had killed the program. And I remember even getting people congratulating me on my role in killing the program, and I didn't believe it. And sure enough, 1993, I went to a conference and sat at a lunch table, and sitting at that table were a whole bunch of people with SDIO on their badge, even though the SDIO office did not exist anymore. And I said, what are you doing with SDIO on your badge? And they smiled and they said, oh, he said he killed the program, but we just changed its name. It's now called BMD. We report 4 levels down in the Pentagon. And I said, what about the budget? And they said, oh, no contracts have been changed. Everything goes on. And I said, what about the goals? And they smiled and said, nope, all goes on. So what they were talking about then and said with such great confidence that they could do, that technology was completely unworkable. Today is 15 years later, and they still can't do it. And now they're trying to say they're trying to do something different. I'll talk about that a little bit later. What I'd like to do now is to show you something interesting, talk about now. When I resigned, I feel it's always very important as a professional to write down something based on my scientific knowledge, not to just make a broad assertion this can or cannot be done. So I made a list of, eight problem characteristics from a computer point of view, things that made this project much harder than any other. And when I would give talks, I would ask people who were on the other side to try to name another project with all of those characteristics. So, for example, they would say, well, we can build nuclear plant control systems. That's perfectly true. But they don't have to deal with unknown physical properties and deliberate deception. They say, well, we can build telephone networks, but the reliability of those networks is very different, and so forth. I had a list. This is not a computer science lecture, so I'm not going to go down this list. But I listed 8 questions you could ask about a project, and I had the SDI column, showed the answers for SDI. Nobody could list another project that would have those same characteristics. Well, today I can, and it's NMD, right? Has exactly the same characteristics with one slight difference. If you look at this one down here where it says the system is easily overloaded in use, if you believe what they say, that they're only going to have a small capacity to get, say, up to 80 or 90 or 100 missiles, that makes it much more easy to overload in use than the old plan, which was designed to take thousands of missiles. mean, one of the things that has always occurred to me, if I were on the other side, and I don't mean by this, somebody trying to make overcome this, if you tell me you have a capacity of 100 missiles, I'm going to make 102. And my 100, the 100 are going to be very inaccurate, because it's not hard to make a missile. It's hard to make an accurate missile. I have two accurate ones and say, pick which ones you're going to shoot at. So you know what they're going to do. They're going to be very happy, right? Because they're just going to say, oh, now we need 200, and then 400, and then 600. And this whole project is really for the technological group, Eisenhower's military-industrial complex. It's just a little thin of the wedge. They'll put it in. They'll get some kind of response. They'll say they need more. And as that guy said to me, the guy from RCA, the nice thing about this project is there's always more money to be made. That's not quite his words, but that's what he meant. Can we have the last slide, please? So let me try to tell you why I've chosen to talk today, even though I really have nothing new to say, right? And that's just to remind you of what's really happened here. We have created Eisenhower's monster. We have created it, and it is so strong, it is not in the control of Congress. I have seen this over and over again. When told to stop a project, they rename it and do it some other way. I remember when Carter said there wouldn't be a B-2 bomber, and then Reagan came to office, there was one for him to see. And I've seen other projects that I've been involved with where you got even the admirals to say, stop doing this, and they just change a name and keep going. It's out of control. And I want to point out that it's here in Canada, too. I was thinking, as I listened, you know, I own a very small dog. Now, if you own a small dog, there are two things that you'll notice about it. The first is, they like to go where the big dogs go. If the big dog is going to raise his leg, the little dog's going to raise his leg. They like to be there. They feel it makes them in good company. The second thing they do, my little dog, he stands up like this and tries to get his nose as high as the big dog's and pretend that he's a big dog. He's not fooling himself. He's not fooling the others, but he seems to enjoy it. And I see, and I, by the way, I think there is a qualitative difference between the Canadian military and the U.S. military, but in the military-industrial complex, the people who see themselves earning money that way, I don't see that much difference. I wish the positive statements made about my new country by Professor Grossman were true, but that's not what I have seen. There are lots of good, honest people, but the system is sick. And one of the things they do, for example, is whenever they want to get scientists to say something, they go around asking them what they believe and telling them there's money in believing something, and they build up a committee or a commission that will say exactly what they want them to say. Now, what this means to me is that there's a huge number of scientists that we have raised today who are betraying their calling. Science is a search for truth, and they're not searching for truth. They're searching for excuses to get more money. And I can also address the engineers. I'm quite strong about being an engineer as well as a scientist. Engineers have a primary responsibility is always protecting the safety of the public. They're not doing that. It's so obvious that they're not doing that. They have forgotten that. And this is because of the monster that we have created. And what I don't really believe that the NMD is, it's just today's facet of this whole thing. It's really this military-industrial complex, and we ought to be using this history to make the public understand what a monster we have created and how we can't believe a word they say. Because that's the trouble. They come up and they sound credible. But if you remind them of what they said in 1985 and point out that they're saying the same things today, I think we can become educators. This is what I hope will happen. Is that you will leave here and think of this as really a teach-in and go out and start teaching by remembering this history from 15, 20 years ago and saying, look what they said then. Why would you believe them now? That's really all I have to say.
That was David Parnas, a former Defense Department scientist, speaking last year at a Science for Peace forum in Toronto, Ontario. Coming up in our second hour, Bruce Gagnon, with the past, present, and future of the U.S. Space Command and what people are doing about it. First, though, the debate that President George Bush never had with Professor Noam Chomsky on the war against Iraq, courtesy of the Boston IMC and the Soundbite Brigade.
This conflict started August 2nd when the dictator of Iraq invaded a small and helpless neighbor.
The crime has nothing to do with invasions, pretty much duplicating what the U.S. had just done a couple of months before in Panama.
Kuwait, a member of the Arab League and a member of the United Nations, was crushed, its people brutalized. 5 months ago, Saddam Hussein started this cruel war against Kuwait.
He certainly is a brutal tyrant and a mass murderer, just as he was when the U.S. was openly supporting him. The overwhelming majority of his crimes were committed during this period when he was a friend and ally.
While the world waited, Saddam Hussein systematically raped, pillaged, and plundered a tiny nation. No threat to his own.
At the time of the Halabja atrocities and later atrocities against the Kurds, the atrocities were being carried out with the support of George Bush and Margaret Thatcher.
He subjected the people of Kuwait to unspeakable atrocities. And among those maimed and murdered, innocent children.
Attack on the Kurds in northern Iraq destroyed large agricultural areas, as well as killing plenty of people, probably tens of thousands.
Innocent children.
Plenty of people, probably tens of thousands.
Murdered.
That gave Bush an opportunity to do a favor for a big U.S. agribusiness, send extensive credits to Saddam Hussein so he can purchase agribusiness exports after they had wiped out agricultural areas in Iraq.
Others traveled to Baghdad in a variety of efforts to restore peace and justice.
I was so concerned to evade diplomatic efforts, and they did.
Arab leaders sought what became known as an Arab solution, only to conclude that Saddam Hussein was unwilling to leave Kuwait.
Chief of Staff Powell, in internal discussion, said the problem is that Saddam may withdraw, leaving a puppet regime in place, at which point everyone in the Arab world will be happy. That's what they expected, and they wanted to prevent.
No choice but to drive Saddam from Kuwait by force. We will not fail.
The rebelling Iraqi generals requested from the United States, from General Schwarzkopf, they wanted to obtain, they didn't want help, but they wanted access to captured Iraqi arms that they could use in their effort to overthrow the tyrant and carry out a popular revolution. That was refused. They were not permitted access to arms. Saddam Hussein was authorized to use military gunships to attack the rebels.
Air attacks are underway against military targets in Iraq. Our operations are designed to best protect the lives of all the coalition forces by targeting Saddam's vast military arsenal.
The bombers destroyed dams, water supply stations, sewage stations,
military arsenal,
pumping stations, electrical system. All of that amounts to biological warfare. You can simply ask yourself what would happen if something comparable was done, say, in Boston. People would be dying like flies from disease and starvation.
Unspeakable atrocities.
It's biological warfare with exactly the catastrophic effect that they predicted.
Iraq will eventually comply with all relevant United Nations resolutions. And then, when peace is restored, it is our hope that Iraq will live as a peaceful and cooperative member of the family of nations, thus enhancing the security and stability of the Gulf.
The rebellion was crushed, Basra was devastated, so were other areas, and the Bush administration was pretty frank about the reasons. It was March 1991, after the so-called war. They simply preferred what they called an iron-fisted Iraqi junta to the threat of a popular revolution.
Cooperative members.
And therefore had to, in the name of what's called stability,
stability of the Gulf,
had to support these major atrocities.
Unspeakable atrocities.
In which, very possibly, as many or more civilians were killed during the bombing the month earlier.
We will not fail.